This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tim McLaurin's first career after he left the Marines was as a Pepsi salesman. His second was as a snake handler with a traveling carnival. Then he was a Peace Corps volunteer in Tunisia, and when he returned to the States, he started to write fiction. His writing was interrupted by bone marrow cancer, which he thinks has been cured by a bone marrow transplant. McLaurin wrote about growing up in the rural South in his memoir, Keeper of the Moon. In his new novel, Cured by Fire, he writes about two men, one a successful professional, the other a migrant worker. Both lose everything they love in fire, and their lives are transformed in unexpected ways. Here's a short reading about Lewis, the professional, who accidentally sets the house on fire after he falls asleep drunk with a lit cigarette.
Lewis lifted his face from water. He looked at the vomit in the toilet, shuddered, and puked up more red liquid. He wiped his mouth with his hand, then lifted his bottle and gagged down more liquor. Lurching into the bedroom, he raised the bottle like a trumpet. He took another cigarette from the pack, lit it, and drew heavily before flopping down on the mattress. Morning now lit the ceiling. The stars he had wandered through had been turned off. The bed was spinning, boring through the floorboards and concrete foundations into the earth. Lewis tasted dirt and worms. He first smelled the smoke, acrid and nasty, then heard the crackle of flames. Where once the sky had stretched above him, he looked into dancing fire. So be it, he thought, I deserve hell. He spat towards the flames. The heat mounted quickly and encircled him just as the vines had done in the garden. Orange and yellow tendrils burned him, and he laughed and howled and cursed as he became one with fire.
Now, I know before writing this novel, you had cancer. Is there a parallel between the significance of that in your life and the significance of the fire in the lives of your characters?
Well, so certainly this novel comes closer to my life than the previous books. I mean, I'm certainly believe that fiction mimics and follows the life of the writer, but this book more closely in that, as you said, I 6 years ago was diagnosed with bone marrow cancer or multiple myeloma, and the ultimate treatment that I received was a bone marrow transplant at the VA hospital in Seattle. And this process involving intense chemotherapy is basically like flames itself. They virtually take you as close to death as possible, burn out the disease inside of you with drugs, and then hopefully you recover and come back up from the the damage and lead or walk forward into life. So in a lot of ways, it parallels the title of this book, Cured by Fire, because my experience was very similar to fire.
When you had your bone marrow transplant, the bone marrow came from your younger brother. And because he was compatible with you, the marrow was compatible with yours. I can't imagine what it was like to be in the position of having to ask him to make that sacrifice. I believe it's a very painful process for the donor, and it took about 3 months of his life to go through that process with you. Was that really hard to ask of him?
Well, certainly Bruce is one of my heroes, but also it was not hard for me to ask this of him or of any other member of the family, because I knew in my own heart that I would without hesitation do the same for any of my siblings or any other person for that matter. So when they were called upon to come and give blood to see who would, if anyone would match me, they all came without hesitation. I have three brothers and two sisters, and Bruce happened to be the one who matched me. Ironically, growing up, we all shared one bedroom, and Bruce and I slept in the same bed together, and so I think it's, you know, sort of strange that we would share the same covers and share also very similar bone marrow.
In one of your previous books, a memoir called Keeper of the Moon, you reprint a letter that your brother left for you at the end of the treatment, and I'd like to read an excerpt of that letter. He wrote, "Tim, I'm not much for expressing my feelings. I just wanted to tell you that I'm glad that I was the one to match with you and was able to give you my marrow. I would also give you my heart if it would help. The time I spent out here gave us a chance to be together as brothers should. I will always cherish this time we had and hope we can stay close and not drift apart as we have in years past.
That's right. And Terry, I'm holding that original letter in my hand right now. I carry it in my wallet as sort of a good luck charm. It's gotten wet a few times when I went swimming and got to take my wallet, or fishing, and not take my wallet out of my pants, but I have the original letter.
My guest is Tim McLaurin. His latest novel is called Cured by Fire. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Tim McLaurin. He used to be a snake handler with a carnival. I asked him how he started handling snakes and what pleasure it gave him.
Well, the first snake I caught was early in life. I was about 6, I guess. I had been taught, like everyone else, to hack snakes into little pieces and that they could do incredible feats that no other animal on earth could do, like chase down horses and roll in a hoop and all these things you hear. And for whatever reason, I saw this snake. I knew it was a green snake. It was not poisonous. I caught it, carried it home, put it in a jar. And then I did something next that was very important. I went to the library and got a book on snakes and started reading. And as I read about snakes, I began to realize that all these things I had been told to believe about reptiles mostly were untrue. And that started me also sort of the seed towards questioning other parts of life. One, that if I didn't want to live in Fayetteville, North Carolina all my life, work a blue-collar job, 9-to-5, go to live and die in the same part of town, if I did not want that life, I didn't necessarily have to. And so I think snakes were very instrumental in opening up the world to me, to making me first go to books and then see that the world is a very different place. And also part of, I guess, my interest in snakes is it's different. It's something other people, most people don't handle poisonous reptiles. But I do have a big interest and fascination in holding a rattlesnake and milking its venom into a glass. And just like some people like to collect stamps.
What do you do with the venom after you've milked it?
Well, back in the old days during the snake shows, I used to drink it as part of my carnival act. I would I'd milk a big rattlesnake into a glass, and then I'd turn up the old few drops of venom and swallow it just to show that it would not hurt you in any way.
Is that true? It only affects you if it's directly into your bloodstream?
Yes, from pit vipers, from hemotoxic venom. You could drink, I mean, I've drank probably a pint of it altogether in my life, and no, it's very quickly neutralized by your stomach juices, by your saliva. Now, if you were to milk a snake into a glass and then draw it up into a syringe and run it into your arm, it would be just like the snake biting you.
What does it taste like?
Well, sort of tasteless. I don't know, sort of a cross between orange juice and tequila, maybe.
Well, I know when you were in your mid-20s, this was in 1977, you quit a job, I believe, as a salesman for Pepsi, to travel with a carnival as Wild Man Mac, the last great snake show. What was your show?
Well, I like to look at it as the last great snake show. I've, since childhood, have been very disillusioned and disappointed by carnival snake shows where you go inside and you see maybe a one big python sitting there, and maybe there's a box with a man sitting there who's supposed to be the snake man from Borneo or whatever, and in reality, he's sitting there with two or three non-poisonous snakes reading a magazine or something. So my show was the real thing. I had cobras, I had coral snakes, rattlers, big pythons. I milked snakes in front of people. I would let kids hold snakes. And the main thrust of the program was not to just be a freak show, but it was to educate people. You know, part of my reason for being there was to show people that snakes are not what we think they are, that they're creatures of the earth like squirrels and birds. Of course, it didn't hurt that I had much more hair at that time. I had long hair and a beard and would draw people in by holding a big rattlesnake and milking it and drinking the venom. I'd get them in the tent and I'd get their quarters, and then hopefully they would leave with a better understanding of reptiles in general.
What would the barker say to get people into your tent?
Oh, it depended on the program. there would be somebody out front saying, live before you, direct from the Amazon, Wild Man Mac, Last Great Snake Show, some similar monologue. But a lot of the times I would just stand in the doorway of the tent and with maybe a boa constrictor wrapped around my neck or something, and that in itself would draw people. They'd come up and start talking, and then I'd say, well, come on inside and see what I have here. And so I generally would have a pretty good flow of people. Even today, I still do reptile programs at schools occasionally for civic organizations. It's something that I'll probably do until I run out of snakes or run out of fingers to hold them with.
In your memoir about your Southern boyhood, you wrote, "We were Southern working-class men expected to hammer out a paycheck, produce children, and hold our liquor. Anything less was a failure." Did handling snakes fit into what your early concept was of what it meant to be a man?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question because I think a lot of my life growing up, those very requirements that you just read of being a Southern man scared me, particularly hammering out a paycheck, because the paychecks that I saw hammered out by my father and most men were strictly for the money earned and by the sweat of their brow. So in some ways, snakes were an escape from that. Most men didn't handle snakes. I remember my father did not like snakes. He was not terrified of them, but he would kill most snakes that he encountered. And so I think early on, I was trying to escape sort of that role that I saw presented to me, that label that defined what is a Southern man. And snakes were a vehicle. It was something curious to most people, something alien. And that, in some ways, I looked at it as a ticket out of lower middle class, working class America.
You know, it seems to me you really wanted to get out of the working class, but you've never particularly wanted to be an upstanding member of the middle class.
Well, that's quite true. It's sort of that's always been a conflict in my life. Maybe I'm just afraid of the work that comes with the blue collar class. Because you're right, I have never wanted to be what you would call a typical yuppie. There's many names for it. And I'm not today. One of my earlier novels was dealing with just that issue, the influx of people, educated people who are paving over the tobacco fields and the forest and building subdivisions. I'm not a part of that. I'm currently actually backpedaling from that way of life. I live in Chapel Hill. I live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which, you know, in itself is a very insulated liberal town, and I'm in the process of building out of my property outside of town and am moving back towards a much simpler life that is much more linked to my childhood and agriculture and animals and things that were important to me growing up. I want to give that to my children so that they will have a side of life that is not just computers and videos and the pleasures of upper middle class life, but that they can see, you know, that the food in a grocery store comes from a garden. It's grown by people who use their hands. It's not sealed in cellophane when it comes out of the earth.
Tim McLaurin, his latest book is the novel Cured by Fire. This is Fresh Air.